Welcome back. We are with Stuart Kaufman in Santa Fe, New Mexico. We were talking about autonomous agents, and a critical element of that was work.
Right.
Constrained
release of energy. You see, the concept of work, I think, as a biologist suffering from physics envy, is a very puzzling concept. And in fact, physicists will tell you that they do most of their scientific work without using the notion of work, but they didn't used to do, okay? And work is all chock-a-block full of stuff in thermodynamics and work cycles and so on. So here's the puzzle. First of all, there's a clear physical definition of work. It's force acting through a distance. So you have a hockey puck and you accelerate a puck on some ice and you measure the increments of acceleration and you add up the energy done, and that's the work done. And it's the final acceleration you've achieved. And it's just a number. It's called a scalar. Here's what's missing. What direction did you push the puck in? That's not in the description. It's in what's called the initial and the boundary conditions of the problem. I'll come back to that in a moment. But in any case of work, there's the actual organization of the process. And in fact, I had you, Paula, pulling on the red handle, moving that cylinder back and forth. And let's pause and think about that. That, too, was the organization of the process. It's not in the description of the work cycle itself, but that pulling and pushing on the handle was utterly essential to the work cycle occurring. Now let's think next about what carries out that coordination or organization of work in a real machine. And the answer is gears and escapements and chains and stuff like that. And Paula's nowhere near there because she might get her hands gushed. Okay? So there's something about an organization of process that is missing in the notion of work, even though in any particular case of work there is an organization of process. But it's not in that scalar number, force acting through distance. I'm going to get to this puzzle in three steps. So the second step is to notice that an isolated thermodynamic system can do no work. It just sits there. But if it be partitioned, for example, by a membrane, if the pressure is higher on one side than the other, then the membrane bulges from side A to B, and work gets done on side B. Well, how did the membrane get itself to be partitioned? Where did this being partitioned? Where did this subjunctive form come from?
Not hocus pocus.
Not hocus pocus in the real universe, but there's a hocus pocus going on. And here's the hocus pocus. Some experimentalist set up the system. Now, where the heck did the experimentalist come from setting up the system? There's this free agent, the experimenter, running around in physics, setting up experiments all the time. Well, that's balderdash. What we want ultimately is a theory in which the experimenter is part of the unfolding of the universe. So the experimenter setting up experiments is a cheat. Now here's the third view of this, which comes from Atkin's book on the second law of thermodynamics. And Atkin says, look, work is itself a thing. Work is the constrained release of energy. So let's picture the cylinder and the piston inside with the working gas, and the working gas expands on the piston and does some work. What are the constraints? Well, evidently, it's the cylinder and the piston, and somebody got the working gas inside the space between the piston head and the cylinder in the first place and stuck some grease in there so that it didn't just all ooze out. Now, those are the constraints. And now I'm going to ask you a puzzling question. Where did the constraints come from? Ah-ha-ha. Well, you see, it actually, in reality, in this case, took work to make the constraints. Somebody made the cylinder, somebody made the piston, somebody put the working gas in there, somebody put the grease in there, and somebody put the piston inside the cylinder. So we come to an apparent cycle. It takes work to make constraints, and it takes constraints to make work. Now, that cycle is nowheres recognized, again, in contemporary physics, insofar as we want the notion of work cycles. Now, I don't say that you always have to do work to create constraints. I'm going to give you a counterexample in a moment. But I want you to feel the puzzle of it, because I think we are pointing towards the heart of a concept of organization, which is missing now in physics and biology. And I'm going to try to show it to you. I'm going to show you a cell doing exactly what I'm talking about. So first, some facts. If you take lipids, fatty materials like cholesterol, and you just dissolve them in water and shake it up, you'll get little soap bubble-like things called liposomes. Each of these liposomes is, in fact, a bilipid layer. Lipids are molecules that have one end that likes water and one end that doesn't like water. The ends that don't like water go together, and the ends that like water stick out into the aqueous, the watery phase, to make a double-layered membrane that is this hollow vesicle, a liposome, which is essentially what a cell membrane is. Now, your cells, a cell, the bacterial cell we started with, does thermodynamic work to link together atoms to make molecules like cholesterol. So that took thermodynamic work. Now, once that's happened, those molecules fall to a low energy state, which is this bilipid layer. Now watch. I'm going to have two imaginary molecules, A and B, which can undergo three different reactions. A and B can convert to C and D, or A and B can convert to E, or A and B can convert to F and G. Now, each of those reactions has what's called an energy profile. So think of a two-dimensional coordinate system. On the x-axis, write reaction coordinate, and on the y-axis, write energy. And now draw something that looks like a Mexican hat with two wells separated by a hump. And what you're supposed to picture is that the beginning molecules, A and B, are sitting in one of the wells, and the products, perhaps C and D, are sitting in another well, and meanwhile there's that hump. Now, the hump is an energy barrier that keeps A and B from changing to C and D. The way enzymes work and other things work to speed up reactions is that they lower that hump between the two wells, making it easier for A and B to convert to C and D. Now, we're ready. A and B, in my little hypothetical story, and in reality, diffuse from the watery interior of the liposome into the fatty lipid membrane. When they do so, they vibrate in a different way, they rotate in a different way, and they go back and forth horizontally and laterally. It's called translational motion in a different way. More precisely, the vibrational, rotational, and translational degrees of freedom and energies are altered. When that happens, the height of the energy barrier by which A and B goes to C and D, or A and B goes to E, or A and B goes to F and G, those energy barriers are changed in some way, either raised or lowered. That raising and lowering of energy barriers is precisely the construction of constraints, because it changes the probabilities of the reactions happening. It's harder to get over a high energy barrier. So the cell has done thermodynamic work by gumbo to create a constraint, which has in fact changed the reaction profiles going in these three directions. But that's not all. The cell does some thermodynamic work to construct an enzyme by linking together amino acids. Now that took thermodynamic work. And the enzyme happens to float into the membrane, and it happens to bind to what's called the transition state where A and B goes to C and D. That transition state is a place where A and B are sort of halfway to C and D, and it's this miserable, unhappy molecule with stretched, distorted bonds. And the enzyme grabs the transition state and stabilizes it, and that's what lowers that potential barrier between A and B going to C and D. And the consequence is that A and B do, in fact, change to C and D. They don't change to E, and they don't change to F and G. So that is precisely the lowering of a potential barrier. So the cells are, in fact, busy manipulating potential barriers to make specific things happen. But now let's watch. Work was done to construct constraints making the lipid membrane and making the enzyme. Now the energy is released from A and B into C and D. It really is. I'm not fibbing, except that it's a hypothetical example. And the consequence of that might be something like the following. D is full of lots of rotational energy. It's spinning and vibrating like mad. And it floats over and it grabs onto a pore that goes across the cell membrane, and it changes the configuration of the pore and opens it up so that an ion can enter. So work is just propagated from the first step to the second step, to opening the channel. then the ion comes in and binds to something, and so work keeps propagating around in cells. There is a continuous linked mixing of spontaneous and non-spontaneous processes by which work propagates from one spot to another spot to another spot to another spot to another spot until something quite astonishing is achieved. The work, propagating work, closes on itself, and the cell builds a second copy of itself. So there's two kinds of closure that an autonomous agent has. It's autocatalytic, namely all of the molecules that have to get formed do get formed via some reaction that gets catalyzed. Notice that that's not local. You can't point to any spot, any single reaction, and say, there it is. It's global. It's somewhere in the whole system. And there is this new kind of closure of propagating work and constraint construction by which a cell builds a copy of itself. Once again, we do not have a notion for this anywhere in biology or physics or chemistry. But I want you to think about this, and you don't have to be a scientist to get the main ideas. Is this matter alone, this closure that propagates? Well, let me say a bit about closure that propagates. Think of a single bacterium making copies of itself. You have one copy, then two, then four, then eight, then 16. This thing that started 4.8 billion years ago when life started, this propagating organization, is not matter alone. It's not energy alone. It's not entropy. Entropy just counts the number of ways things can be organized. It's not that. It's not one minus entropy. It's not Shannon's famous information either. It's something else that we don't have a name for. I think it's organization. And I think that autonomous agents exhibit to us self-propagating organization that makes more of itself. Now, I think I've told you something new. I think I've told you a new physical concept. I don't know how to mathematize it. I have some ideas about how to mathematize it, but they're all inadequate as far as I can tell. So, you see, there's something going on in a biosphere, and I'd like to close some loops, and there's one other part I want to talk about that talks about the universe at large. But we have something very mysterious going on. We have autonomous agents that are propagating organization that, because of Darwinian preadaptations that cannot be stated ahead of time, discover novel ways of making a living, which afford opportunities for yet more novel ways of making a living, by which this global organization that is the biosphere as a whole does in fact link spontaneous and non-spontaneous processes so that the sun shining really does build redwood trees in the American Northwest. They're real big. That's staggering. There's nothing going on but the sun shining in 4 billion years and some hot thermal vents, and there's all of this complex stuff out there. So in our story, we are confronting something that is forever becoming, but which we cannot say ahead of time what will become. So that innovation, it seems to me, is real in the universe. Okay, it's real, and it changes the way the universe unfolds every time a Darwinian preadaptation occurs and we have a new form of life that arises. And it's true in technological evolution as well. We have Chevrolets and you know, various and sundry kinds of trucks.
There is something new under the sun, then.
There is persistently something new under the sun. So I guess there's two more points I want to make. Each of them is kind of surprising. Think of the number of proteins length 200. Well, any protein length 200 has 20 kinds of amino acids in each position, so the number of possibles are 20 times 20 times 20 times 20, 200 times. 20 to the raised to the 200th power is 10 raised to the 260th power, which is a big number. Now let's just do a little calculation. The universe is 14 billion years old. In the known universe, there's 10 raised to the 80th particles. Suppose particles banged into one another real often. How many particles could bang? How many pairwise collisions could there be? Well, 10 to the 80th squared, so it's 10 to the 160th. That's ignoring the fact that some of them are far apart and can't actually bump into one another, so this is an overestimate. Chemical reactions take 10 to the minus 15th, or a femtosecond. There's 10 to the 33rd femtoseconds since the start of the universe, plus or minus a few. How many pairwise collisions can there have been since the start of the universe on a femtosecond time scale? 10 to the 80th times 10 to the 80th times 10 to the 33rd, which is a huge number. It's 10 to the 193rd, which is huge, but it's a lot less than 10 to the 260th. And that means the following thing. The universe has not had time to create all possible proteins length 200 once in the lifetime of the universe. In fact, it would take 10 to the 67th repetitions of the lifetime of the universe to create all possible proteins length 200 just once. And that means that at levels of complexity above atomic nuclei, the universe is grotesquely non-repeating, which means that when a Darwinian pre-adaptation happens for example, a flying squirrel comes into existence, it changes the unfolding of the universe forever. The universe is unfolding in some particular way, and I think that there is this law that for biospheres, they become as diverse as possible. Now I want to try to circle back to the last point. There's something very puzzling going on, and it's tied to the famous Maxwell demon story. And it has to do with, why is the universe complex? You see, we really don't know why the universe is complex. We see the second law, which is supposed to end in the heat death of the universe, but the universe around us is complex as heck. I mean, for example, there's trucks and Chevrolets and operas and radio equipment and television equipment and bacteria and bugs and all this complex stuff going on around here. And
if you don't believe it, look out the window.
And if you don't believe it, look out the window. So here's the funny thing about Maxwell's demon. See, Maxwell was trying to show that there's something funny and statistical about the second law of thermodynamics. So he imagined the following paradox. He said, imagine we have an isolated box of gas separated into a left chamber and a right chamber and a little teeny flap valve, a little teeny window, and a demon who's a wee creature because Maxwell was Scots. And what happens is, originally the gas is at equilibrium, namely the pressure and the temperature in the left and the right half of the box is the same. But the demon sees fast molecules coming from the left, and whenever he does, he opens the flap valve and he lets the fast molecules into the right box, then closes it. And whenever there's a slow molecule coming from the right towards the left, he opens the flap valve and the slow molecule goes into the left box. Well, after a little while, the right box is hotter than the left box. It's got all the fast molecules in it. And then, as Maxwell points out, it's easy to extract work from the system. For example, you could take a little windmill and put it right next to the flap valve, open the flap valve. There would be a transient wind, and the windmill would orient towards the wind and spin. So Maxwell's demon is the place where matter, energy, and information come together. Now, there's a bunch of work saving the second law in the face of Maxwell's demon, and I'm not going to take you through all of that. But in general, the answer is that it's okay.
Thank you.
And basically, it's because the information that the demon acquires about the system has to get erased eventually, and it takes energy to erase the information, and it takes just the amount of energy to erase the information as you could have used to get work out from an equilibrium system. In a non-equilibrium system, it pays to measure, okay, and then you can get work out. Now, here's what's missing from the standard story. See, the story is that the point of the demon's doing his fancy business and doing all this measurement in a non-equilibrium setting, where it does pay to measure, is that then, in principle, you could get work out of the system. And let's take the case that just did it. I just had a little windmill, and the vane orients the thing towards the wind so that the fan's perpendicular to the transient wind, and then the blades spin. Okay? Now, I want to ask the following questions. I'm going to notice something first. Let's suppose that we've got our left box and our right box, and the molecules are moving faster in the right box than in the left box, but there's an identical number of molecules in the right and the left box. So it's hotter in the right box than the left box. Now, let's suppose that the demon does a measurement. He takes a magic photograph that shows the positions of all of the gas molecules in the right box and in the left box. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
From that measurement, he cannot deduce that the molecules are going faster in the right box than the left box, because he just took it at one moment. If he took two pictures, he'd know. Or if he measured how hard the molecules were banging against the wall, the momentum transfer, he could find out that the right box is hotter than the left box. Okay? And that means the following essential thing. How does the demon know what to measure? He could measure something that's utterly useless with respect to extracting work. Point one. So how does the demon get to know what to measure? I'm going to tie this in a moment to how does the universe manage to become complex. But for the moment, how does the demon know what to measure? And the second thing is even if he does figure out what to measure and makes a useful measurement, where does this device come from that actually extracts work? That has to happen too, right?
Right.
Now, the universe has become complex. So let's think for a moment about Darwinian preadaptations in the biosphere. They accomplish precisely the windmill kind of story, because if there is something that happens whereby a measurement of a displacement from equilibrium occurs, and that measurement does in fact identify a displacement from which work could be extracted, and if a device happens to be around that can use that, it'll get used to extract work, and it'll confer a selective advantage, or it might confer a selective advantage. So organisms like bacteria use all sorts of energy sources, from hot vents and sulfur, and I mean, there's bacteria living down on the rock 10 miles down, and they get it from the sun, and they get it from rhodopsin all over the place, right? So I want you to notice that what's happened in the biosphere is that, in fact, what comes into existence are things that do measure the right features to pick up displacements from equilibrium from which work can be extracted, and do come up with devices from which work is extracted. That extracting of work is the linking of spontaneous and non-spontaneous processes that builds redwood trees, and that's why there's redwood trees out there.
Who are autonomous agents?
Who are autonomous agents. Now, this isn't just the biosphere, I don't think. I think this is a larger story about how the universe gets itself to be complex. And we do not have a theory for that in physics. It must have something deep to do with the fact that in the universe, as it unfolds, as symmetries are broken, as more diversity comes into existence, then there are more ways by which things can couple and happen to be able to detect displacements from equilibrium from which things can further couple such that other things get themselves built. And I suspect that's true of geomorphology. It may be true of galactic evolution. And it's certainly true of the evolution of the biosphere. So let me put all of this roughly together in my strange investigations. I started with wondering about autonomous agents. I think I may have a definition of life, but in any case, I've specified something that is constructible. We'll make them sometime in the next 20 or 30 years. We will put them in a pot, and we will not be able to say ahead of time what their adaptations are going to be. It's going to drive the physicists crazy, because the physicists and the chemists are used to thinking that we can say ahead of time what can happen, and I think here we just will not be able to. I think we will confront creativity. So here is where we, as human agents, tell stories, because we are telling how to orient as autonomous agents and make sense of our world. So C.P. Snow's two cultures come together in this limitation of science as the physicists taught us how to do it in the genius of Newton and all that followed that. Meanwhile, we're missing a notion of organization. And autonomous agents show us a notion of propagating organization that I don't know how to mathematize. And I can say why now. Every way that I know how to mathematize it has the property that you have to be able to say ahead of time what all the possibilities are. And I don't know how to say ahead of time what all the possibilities are. So I don't know how to mathematize it. And I think this means something utterly profound. And to summarize it, I think it means that, you see, we do not deduce our lives, we live our lives. So that at first it's terrifying to think that we cannot deduce it all ahead of time. And then with some grunt of relaxation, we realize, oh, for the past 4 billion years, we've been doing it anyway. Which brings us back maybe to the final point I'll make. It's strange that this ties to business, because you see, business is busy making its livings in a world that businesses co-construct. We cannot say ahead of time what the next adaptation will be, what the next technological evolution will be, that will wipe some ways of making a living out of existence and create other new ways of making a living. Look at the internet. Biology teaches us one thing preeminently, and that is, organisms have learned to be adaptive. Namely, if they can't deduce it ahead of time, and they can't, they're adaptive, and some fair number of them manage to survive, otherwise we wouldn't be here. So as Horatio said, or as somebody said to Horatio, as Hamlet said to Horatio, there are more things in this world than in your philosophy.
Stuart Kaufman will be back in just a moment.